You're saying I should go longer than that clock says, I guess.
A little bit.
A little bit.
Because we show pretty much late as we can.
I don't want to be sitting there those extra minutes that you guys have.
So, questions? Lots of graphs. So we were talking cross sections experimentally, classically. So experimentally, you take your target sample, relatively thin sample, and you calculate the number of nuclei you have per area. And this is how you would do that. Density times thickness divided by the mass of an atom. Incidentally, targets are usually classified by their thickness. That is to say, the label on a target would probably be in the units of grams per square centimeter. And then you look at, you shine your particles at that target, and you look at the fraction of the particles that are scattered, and you divide that by this two-dimensional number density, and that's what the total cross-section is. Nuclear cross-sections, particle physics cross-sections, are typically done in a unit of barns, and the name is supposed to be indicative, as you can't miss the side of a barn. So this is a big cross-section, 10 Fermi square. The size of a nucleus, or excuse me, the size of a proton is a radius of maybe 1 Fermi. So one barn is the kind of geometrical size of a pretty big nucleus. And usually you don't have the full geometrical cross-section going for you. Differentials cross-section, how are the scattered particles distributed in space? Where are they going? So count the number that are scattered into some particular solid angle, divide that by that solid angle and N2, and we get the differential scattering cross-section. So that would be typically in barns per stir radian, where stir radian is the solid angle, which we've talked about before. No one else except this textbook is going to describe the differential scattering cross-section with a capital D. I'll pretty much use D sigma D omega. So classically, we can calculate the scattering cross-section using classical mechanics by just solving the problem that we have a particle that has some distance from dead on from the target. Call that distance the impact parameter. Calculate the exit angle, and we get a function of theta is a function of B, and then we show that the differential scattering cross-section satisfied that formula. Might be worth reminding you about what a rainbow is. So a rainbow is a bright spot in the sky, and it's going to have an infinite differential scattering cross-section at that particular angle because d theta dB is zero, right? So we have 1/0, which is infinity. At least on this floor. So that's why rainbows are bright. They're colored, of course, because the scattering angle depends a little bit on the color of light. So we looked at a couple of examples. Hard sphere billiard balls. The scattering's isotropic, equal in every angle. Rutherford scattering, we only did it approximately. There's lots of small angle scattering, and the total cross-section is infinite, which is a problem that we're going to ignore in this textbook. Oh, we also talked a little bit about another problem we're basically going to ignore, and that's what frame we're working this in. So in the old days, the target was fixed and you threw projectors at it, so that's called the lab frame, where we have colliding beams. That's the center of mass frame, and the angle of scattering is different in those two frames. So there are kind of longish equations that would allow you to convert an angle measured in the lab frame to one measured in the center of mass frame. And we're mostly going to be doing things in the relative coordinate system, which is basically the same thing as the center of mass frame, except we only have one equivalent particle that has a reduced mass that's given by the product of the masses divided by the sum. Questions? So kind of the aim of scattering projects is to figure out, originally, is to figure out what the force law was for the nucleus, right? We think we understood Coulomb's law for atomic forces, but what's holding the neutrons and the protons together was a dark mystery in 1935. And I guess it might be worth commenting at this point or some other point that the differential scattering cross-section can't tell us everything. Do notice, for example, that repulsive Rutherford scattering has exactly the same differential scattering cross-section as attractive Rutherford scattering, right? Because Z is squared, right? Exactly the same differential cross-scattering, whether we're talking about attraction or repulsion. So differential scattering cross-section doesn't tell us everything, but it tells us something, and there's a hope that if we measure it, we can figure out things like force laws. So this is a class in quantum mechanics, not classical mechanics. So how do we calculate these quantities in quantum mechanics? And kind of the basic idea you should have, of course, is now we have waves as opposed to particles. So here I have a plane wave that's propagating up the z-axis, and I'm going to get scattered waves that are going out more or less radially. And what I mean then by the scattering cross-section is the number scattered per second divided by the incoming flux, right? So basically we're saying that the scatterer is drilling a hole in this incoming plane wave, and all of the flux that's in that hole is what's doing the scattering. So kind of theoretically, we're going to deal with one particle and a wave, whereas practically, I mean, it's nice to have lots of scattering. Practically, we deal with lots of scattering sources at the same time. But assuming that we have incoherent sums, so we don't get constructive interference and destructive interference from separate nuclei, then we should be able to just carry out the experiment with lots of nuclei simultaneously present. Okay, so what's psi, right? Everything is psi. What is psi for this sort of case? Well, it goes without saying that when we're in the midst of the force law, things are going to be pretty complicated. But as long as we exclude that region, things are pretty simple. Because if we exclude that region from consideration, we just have free particle, and we've solved free particle. So we know, for example, that perfectly good solution, if there's no potential, is right, e to the I kz. Right? That represents a wave that's propagating up the z-axis. And we know, we've also solved the problem in spherical coordinates, and we know what the solution is for waves that are in spherical coordinates. And those were spherical Bessel functions. And in particular, for outward going waves like this, these things were Hankel functions. Sounds pretty obscure. I've never bothered to figure out who Hankel was. I assume it's a person. So the upshot, and you have this, I'll read it off here, we won't really need this too much, is the Hankel function was a linear combination of the spherical Bessel functions. Those are the ones that were well behaved at the origin. And the solution was all k times r. And then we had plus or minus I times the solution that was irregular at the origin. And the book calls those eta. And it's not an uncommon notation, but pretty standard mathematical sources usually call that y. So this is the solution to the Bessel, to the wave equation in spherical coordinates that's regular at the origin, and we've run into it before. These were the wave functions for the infinite square well. And we only mention these ones that go to infinity as r goes to zero, but they're perfectly normal if r isn't equal to zero. And so we can make a nice linear combination of these two guys. And these things, if we use a plus sign, this is called a Hankel function of type 1. If we use a minus sign, these are Hankel functions of type 2. And these are, of course, going to be functions of kr. And for large r, these things have to decrease like 1 over r, right? Because the same flux is now being distributed over a sphere, and of course things depend on psi squared, so we know the amplitude, we need the amplitude to go down like 1 over r squared, and psi going like 1 over r will do it for us. And then we've got e to the plus minus I kr, and then there's some other stuff which I guess I'll write it exactly the way it is here and then write it another way also. Some sort of phase factor. And if you think about what this means, remember that e to the I pi over 2. Anyone know what e to the I pi over 2 is? Well, certainly equal to cosine of pi over 2 plus I sine pi over 2. Anyone know what cosine of pi over 2 is?
Zero.
So this thing's equal to I. So what we have here is this quantity, including the minus sign, is 1 over I to the L plus 1 if we have this plus sign. Otherwise, it's the minus sign. Okay, so the solution that we have to have out here has to be some combination of Hankel functions and outgoing waves, so it has to be some combination of the H1s. Right? There might be five of L equals 2, I mean some linear combination of these guys for various values of L, but they all have the same behavior. So whatever linear combination you make of these Hankel functions, it's going to go like 1 over r e to the I kr. And I guess I can put the k down here too if you want. All right, with some amplitude. I don't mean to imply that the amplitude has to be 1. In fact, I think I'll call it f. Okay, so outside of this region where things are complicated, the wave function has to go, and I'm going to write a lot of equal signs in this lecture, and what they really mean is equal outside of the region where things are complicated. So I'll just say that once. So outside, we can have this plane wave that's going up the z-axis, and we can have some amount of Hankel function for an outward going wave. And this time I intentionally didn't write the k. Okay, so it has to be that way, right? It's the only way it can be. If we're inside the potential, things are going to be complicated. And let me remind you that we're intentionally not covering the hard cases like Coulomb's law, where we have a potential that extends to infinity. So we're thinking about the potential being limited in range. So there really is a well-defined region outside of which it's exactly free particle. That if we have Coulomb scattering, I've said lots of times, it's doable, but mathematically more of a mess. So what's this incoming flux? Well, we've calculated the flux of this sort of wave lots of times, right? It's basically the density times the velocity. And of course, the momentum is just kh bar. So this incoming flux is then the magnitude of a squared kh bar divided by the mass, and really by the mass I mean the reduced mass mu. What's the number that are scattered per second? Well, this is the scattering. How many of them are going to be scattered into some solid angle d omega? Well, the front surface of a d omega is r squared d omega, right? That's the full surface area. So if I take this guy and calculate the flux, I'm going to get magnitude of a squared, magnitude of f squared divided by r squared, same speed, so this is going to be kh bar over m. And then the number that are going to be scattered into our detector at some distance r is given by that result. So you can see, I think, the result is that the differential scattering cross-section is just whatever that f is, magnitude squared. So the quantum mechanics is, find me what f is, and then that'll tell me what the differential scattering cross-section is. So the problem we've set ourselves is, given some candidate nuclear potential, calculate f, and from f we can get the differential scattering cross-section, we can compare it to experiment. If it doesn't work, we can try another potential and see how it works. Okay. Okay, so this problem of giving a potential, calculate the scattering amplitude, is what f is called, is going to be kind of a messy mathematical calculation, which we're definitely going to want to do. We have to suffer through this once. The answer, the answer isn't as bad as the algebra, but the algebra is pretty bad, so it doesn't seem like a real benefit. But these are graphs of exactly this stuff. So the middle graph, that's the total cross-section that we would get as a function of k, the wave number. And this is for a particular potential, our friend, the finite depth square well, attractive square well potential. In dimensionless coordinates, and the u's here are various depths of the potential. So as we go to bigger u, we're making the potential deeper. The radial size of the potential has been pulled out to have nice dimensionless coordinates. The thing that might be in the third row is a blow up of these little peaks that are occurring at various spots. And what's in the top layer is the thing that we need to calculate in order to get these differential cross sections. Okay, so I know this is a proof that it's possible to somehow or other calculate these differential scattering cross sections for a particular potential. Okay, so the starting point is something that I'm not going to prove. I'm just going to make it plausible, and that is, we know that e to the ikz is a solution to the Schrodinger wave equation. And it's definitely regular at the origin, right? Nothing special is happening when z is equal to 0. And we also have solutions to the Schrodinger equation that are in spherical coordinates, that are regular at the origin. So we have completeness, so it must be possible to write this function of z in terms of the spherical Bessel functions. Right? That's just a statement about completeness. Now, one thing that's kind of important to remember, and I guess I've kind of erased it, is this problem is axially symmetric. Right, so I set the wave to be going up the z-axis, so this phi is the same as that phi. The only thing that matters is the angle I'm from the z-axis. So the full solution, of course, In general, this would be a YLM, but since we have axial symmetry, the full solution just has Legendre polynomials. And it's not a whole lot of mess to calculate that this e to the ikz is equal to this particular linear combination of regular solutions in spherical coordinates. Okay, so we're going to need that in 15 minutes from now. But you can, that's the kind of thing we're going to be doing. We're going to be taking our rectangular solutions and writing them kind of in spherical solutions. Okay, so the starting point has got to be solving Schrodinger's equation, right? So what we have is minus h bar squared over 2m, two derivatives with respect to r, plus 2 over r, derivative with respect to r. We've got a centrifugal potential. And in general, I have this actual potential that's there. And I'm doing this for some particular energy, right? I'm shining in my particles with some particular momentum and hence energy. And I need to solve this differential equation. And there's no nice thing to do about it. You can solve such a differential equation with Mathematica if you want. Because it's just a, so in this case, this is a known quantity. Right, namely h bar squared k squared over 2m. So the only thing you need are boundary conditions, and what we need is to have this be regular at the origin. Right, so if we start out r so that it goes like r to the l as r goes to 0, we can use Mathematica to solve the differential equation. Right, so in the end, what we get out of Mathematica is some sort of plot for what r is as a function of angle. But we don't have to integrate this all the way to infinity, because we know what the solution is when v is equal to 0. It must be that this solution for, if we're outside of the potential, this function of r that we get from solving Mathematica has to be a linear combination of the corresponding spherical Bessel functions. So inside we have complications due to the potential, but outside it's got to be some linear combination, because the linear combination is the solution to the Schrodinger equation. Okay, so far so good. Maybe, maybe not. So use Mathematica to solve this equation for the actual potential. Integrate it using Mathematica out to where the potential goes to 0. And write it as a linear combination of these two guys. How do you do that? Well, you use solve, right? You can solve for these a and b coefficients. Okay, so these things are basically known in the sense that Mathematica can calculate them for you. It might be worth commenting, of course, that the overall normalization really is free. That is to say, if I started this thing twice as big, it's going to be twice as big. So I basically want to pull the normalization out of this equation. And I'm going to do that in the following way. So I'm going to take out the square root of al squared plus bl squared. And I'm going to be left over then with two terms. And these terms are less than 1, and if I add them in square, I get 1. So these things have to be the cosine of some angle. I'm going to choose a minus sign, the sine of some angle. Okay, so the upshot is from Mathematica, I can get these coefficients A and B. From that, I can take the inverse cosine of this thing, and I can get what delta is. And I can do this for any value of k that you care about. Okay, so I can now tell you what's on that top graph. The top graph are plots of those, we usually call them phase shifts. And they're color-coded according to the code that's on the first page of yours, but I guess I don't have that page here myself. So red is the phase shift for angular momentum 0, and orange is the phase shift for angular momentum 1. Green is the phase shift for angular momentum 2, and so it goes. All as a function of k. Okay, so it is a pretty big Mathematica project. For lots of different k's, I have to calculate lots of different phase shifts. And I'm still not there yet, right? Because I don't know what f is, I just know what these deltas are. But the claim is that if I know these deltas, I can calculate what the phase shifts are. Okay, so now we're going to do a bunch of manipulations which are going to seem like I'm putting the rabbit in the hat and then pulling it out sideways, that sort of stuff. They're not going to seem like they make a lot of sense. But bear with me. In the end, we will, in fact, why not let the rabbit a little bit out of the hat now? So it turns out that at the end, when the dust settles, we're going to have a formula for f of theta. Namely, we have to add up over all possible of these angular momentums 2l plus 1 divided by k e to the 2i delta l minus 1 divided by 2y times pl of cosine theta. So if I know what the delta l's are, I do know what f is, and if I know what f is, I can square it to get the differential scattering cross section. Okay, so here comes the seemingly weird weird set of manipulations where things go and come back and are set sideways. So let me call this kind of normalized version of R psi tilde sub L. So psi tilde sub L is equal to cosine of delta L JL, and this time I'll write the KR, minus sine of delta L, the other Bessel function, KR. Okay, so kind of the first thing I'm going to do is to, instead of expressing things in terms of J's and Y's, I'm going to express them in terms of the Hankel functions, because the Hankel functions are kind of what we want in the end, right? They're the H1 is the outward going wave that we want to get. Okay, so if I do that, JL is equal to 1 half H1 plus H2, right? Because if I add H1 to H2, the Y term is going to cancel out. And this Y term is 1 over 2i H1 minus H2. Right? Because if I switch around this sign and then add, I'm going to get a 2i, which cancels that 2i. So if I do that, what I've got is overall factor of 1 half. In front of the H1, I've got cosine of delta L minus 1 over I sine of delta L. In front of the H2, I've got cosine of delta L plus 1 over I sine of delta L. And I remind you that 1 over I is equal to minus I. So this thing here is just equal to e to the I delta L, and this thing here is just equal to e to the minus I delta L. Okay. So, and this psi L tilde is a solution to R. So now let me write another solution to R without the tilde. So this is going to be a solution to the same differential equation. What's different about it is that I'm going to have pulled out this e to the I delta L. So this thing is going to be equal to 1/2. Excuse me, this is the one I'm going to have pulled out. 1/2 of H2 plus e to the 2i delta L H1. Okay, so this is a solution to Schrodinger's equation. So if I multiply this whole thing by e to the I delta L, it's still a solution to Schrodinger's equation, right? Multiplying by a constant doesn't change the fact that it solves the differential equation. So now I do the following trick. This is a solution to the differential equation. A linear combination of that is also a solution to the differential equation. So let's take a linear combination that is cleverly made in order to give me what I want. So let me take 2L plus 1 I to the L times psi L PL cosine theta. Okay, so a linear combination of solutions is still a solution to Schrodinger's equation. So that's a perfectly good solution to Schrodinger's equation. If I'm inside the potential, it's a solution to Schrodinger's equation. If I'm outside the potential, then not only is it a solution to the Schrodinger's equation, it also is of exactly that form. Okay? So here's where I kind of bring back what I did. So remember, I started by swapping the J's and Y's for H's, and now I'm going to do the reverse, at least partially the reverse. I want to have things in terms of H1s because they're outgoing waves, and I want to have things in terms of J's because J's are what I need to make e to the ikz. So my plan is to take this H2 and express it in terms of, to try and get a J out of that H2. In order to get a J out of this H2, I need to have plus H1, right? That would give me a J2. But I can't just do that willy-nilly, so I better subtract H1 also. Okay, so what I've got then is H1 plus H2 divided by 2, that's just JL. And what I have left over is the stuff I had to have. It's e to the I 2 delta L minus 1 times this Hankel function. Okay, so I remind you, that's a solution to Schrodinger's equation. Perfectly good solution. A linear combination of it is a solution, and that J term is exactly what I need in order to have this be e to the ikz. And what do I have left over? Well, what I have left over is the sum of 2L plus 1 I to the L. And then I have these phase shifts, e to the 2i delta L minus 1 divided by, or it's not divided by 2i yet, times PL. And then I've got those Hankel functions, H1. Well, what is a Hankel function? What is the H1? Well, this is what it is. It's, for large R at least, it's 1 over kr I to the L plus 1 e to the i kr. So, I to the L, I to the L. Oh, I dropped my 2. Is there a 2 in that? Oh, there's this overall 1/2 here. Yes. That's still in my JL. Here it is. Good. So this is now over 2i, the extra I coming from this plus 1. And I've got then exactly what I wanted, right? I have something that is multiplied by e to the I kr over r. And whatever that is f. So there's my formula for f. So I don't know if you're happy with that or not, but what I hope I've demonstrated for you is if you tell me what v is, I can find these phase shifts, delta L, and then I can do that sum, and I can calculate F, and then I can calculate the differential scattering cross-section. I can compare it to experiment. Yes?
What's the step to go from F to the cross-section again?
Just square it.
Just square it, okay.
Yep. So the scattering amplitude when magnitude squared is the differential scattering cross-section. So that step, at least, is relatively easy. How do we go from F to total cross-section? And maybe before we do this, there are lots of ways of writing this formula. If I pull out an e to the I delta L, then I'm going to have e to the I delta L minus e to the minus I delta L all over 2i. So another way of writing that is that, if you like that better. Okay, so what's the total cross-section? Differential scattering cross-section is just going to be the f squared. The total cross-section is, of course, going to be the integral of d omega of the differential scattering cross-section squared. So one of these guys is that ugly sum over there, right? The sum of 2l plus 1 over k. And I'm going to do one other final simplification. I'm going to call that FL just so I don't have to write it again. So I need to write it by itself and then take its complex conjugate. So, and so I don't mess up the L's. This is going to be a sum over L prime, and this is going to be a sum over L. It's exactly the same sum. We're okay?
Yeah. Are those PEs? What are those again?
Those are the Legendre polynomials. And we had those Legendre polynomials in E and M where we had the magic of orthogonality. So this double sum we're never going to have to do because unless L equals L prime, it's going to be 0. So what we're going to end up with then is, so this integral d omega is equal to 4 pi divided by 2L plus 1, you might remember that, times a delta function, right? L has to equal L prime. So we only end up with a single sum, And we've got this 4 pi, and we got this k squared. And one of these 2l plus 1s is going to get canceled out, but we're still going to have one left. Oh, this is the total cross-section. Yeah, we're done. And if I substitute back, the magnitude of FL is just sine squared of delta L. Okay, so if you tell me the potential, solve Schrodinger's equation, find the delta L's, then the total cross-section is just an infinite sum. Do I actually have to do all of these delta L's? No. Because remember about basically the WKB approximation. If we look at the effective potential, right, so here's my actual potential, my nuclear potential that goes out to some distance r, but then there's a centrifugal potential too. And the more angular momentum, the bigger the centrifugal potential, right? This is the thing that's L plus 1 h bar squared divided by 2m r squared. So if I'm at a low energy, the wave function is never going to see that potential. It's going to be exactly as if that potential weren't there. Well, I say exactly. It's going to be very close to the situation when the potential isn't there. When the potential isn't there, the solution is just a JL. And if the solution is just a JL, then the phase shift has to be an integer multiple of pi, right? Because the term in front of the y was sine delta L. So for low energies and big L, delta L better be equal to some integer multiple of pi. If you look at these graphs, at low energy, which is to say small k, you'll see that they all either start at 0 or pi, or if you look at the very back, 2 pi. How do these things change? Well, the one I happen to have, here's one that starts at, so let's look at 45. It's going to be one of, probably on page 3 or so of this handout. So when I look at this, what I see is that for small k, violet is basically 0, right? It picks up at around 4. Blue picks up at around 1.7 or something like that, but generally it's been 0. Teal, pretty much been pi from the start. Orange started out as 2 pi, but it's now starting to deviate noticeably. And red, which is L equals 0, deviated linearly right from the get-go. Everyone agree with that summary? Okay, so at the lowest possible energy, what we're going to have is all of these guys being integer multiples of pi, mostly 0, except for the 0 phase shift. In this particular case, it's equal to 2 pi, and then it's going down linearly proportional to k, right? That is to say, we could Taylor expand this delta of 0. So let me call the Taylor expansion, the linear term in that Taylor series expansion A. And A is important enough that it's given a name. It's the scattering length. Okay, so repeating what the scattering length is, it's the linear term in the Taylor series expansion for L0. And it's actually minus that. And let's think about for a second units. What are the units of A? Well, the units of K are inverse length, right? They needed to be inverse length because we had things like e to the I k times z, right? So delta is unitless, so this scattering length, in fact, does have the units of length. And if we plug that in to this formula, what we're going to get is for small angles, the sine of an angle that's near zero or near pi is about equal to theta. So this is going to give us a squared times k squared. And the k squareds are going to cancel. L is equal to zero. It's the only term in this sum because everything else is zero. So what we've got is the scattering length is going to determine the total cross section at low momenta, low energies. Okay, how about these things that suddenly rise up? You know, like the blue one did at about 1.7. What's going on there? So if we think about what the, so for something like a nuclear potential, there is, the total potential still has a classically allowed region, right? We have these nuclei that are bouncing around, so the total potential looks kind of like that. And so the total wave function, when I go to solve Schrodinger's equation, you know, I'm going to get something that's oscillating around, and typically, it's going to hit exponentially decaying solution, right, in order to connect up with this guy here. At least that's what it's going to be if it's a quasi-bound state. If we don't have the energy quite right, then more typically this thing is going to connect up to an exponentially growing solution. Right? So the only time we actually get this connecting up to an exponentially decay solution is if we hit the energy of a bound state inside the potential. People pretty much believe that?
Because that other state isn't a real bound state, like it would never exist, right?
So none of these are real bound states, right? But this one is at least quasi-bound. This thing here is only going to occur as a scattering state. And what it's telling us is that if we don't have the right energy, it takes a really big amplitude outside to get any amplitude at all inside. Kind of the reverse of tunneling. Tunneling from the outside as opposed to the inside. So in this sort of situation, we have a solution that looks just like the JLs. So we're going to have one of these wave shifts that's basically an integer multiple of pi. And that's also going to be true if we're at an energy that's a little bit below. Right? It's going to have a little bit longer wavelength, but when it comes up here, it's not going to have the magic situation to connect to exponentially decaying. It's going to hit the usual solution of exponential growth, and it's going to have to be big on the outside. So what this means is when we change the energy just a little bit, we're going to go from one value of integer multiple of pi to another integer multiple value of pi. And right in between where we have this quasi-stable state, that's where we're going to get what's between integer multiples of pi, namely we're going to get, you know, 90 degrees plus or minus 180 degrees. And what's important about that is that's where sine is big. Yeah, so that's why we get this resonant peak. That's why we get suddenly a much bigger total cross-section right at this particular spot where we go through 90 degrees in the process of going between 0 and pi. So every one of these jumps corresponds to a resonant state. So in particle physics, basically everything is one of these quasi-stable states, right? Pions decay. So if we want to discover particles, we usually pick them out as resonant states, just like this, where we have a corresponding peak in the wavelength. What does the differential cross-section look like in the vicinity of this transition between 0 and pi in the L equals, what's blue? You have it on your front sheet. I don't have it. Is it 4?
3 is light blue, 4 is dark blue.
4, yep. Well, remember that the differential scattering cross-section is given by this big term. And most of those terms are going to be small because the corresponding phase shift is an integer multiple of pi. The biggest term in this sum will come about, will have a magnitude of f that's equal to 1. So right at that resonance, the differential scattering cross-section will look like a sum of small terms, so it won't be 0, but there will be a contribution from all of those other phase shifts. But at that particular phase shift, we're going to get a p4 squared of cosine theta. Okay, so at a little bit of energy below that resonance, we're going to get, it turns out basically isotropic scattering. A little bit above that resonance, we're going to get basically isotropic scattering. Right at that resonance, we're going to get scattering that's proportional to p4 squared plus a constant. Okay, so not only is there a sudden change in the total cross-section, there's also a change in the differential cross-section. And from the change in the differential cross-section, we can figure out what the angular momentum is, right? P4 has four zeros, right? Four nodes in it. So when you square it, it's still going to have four nodes in it. So we can look for the dips in the differential scattering cross-section, and that tells us the L value of the resonance. It basically tells us the angular momentum of the particle, I call it a particle, the resonant state that we've created in this scattering experiment. Okay, so we're kind of running out of time, but let me flip a few. I guess I could have actually done that earlier because I have some of these as transparencies. But I did want to show you some real data. So remember, we really can't do charged particles because then we have Rutherford scattering on top of nuclear scattering, and we don't want to go there. So what we're doing here is NP scattering, neutron scattering off protons. And this is a graph of the total cross-section, which you can measure. Notice these units are in barns. We got several barns. And these A's are the scattering length that we have for this problem. And okay, so there's an additional complication that everything's always a little bit more complicated than in the book. We got spin particles, right? So we have one case that they're coming in triplet, and we got another case where they're coming in singlet. Anybody know which one has the bound state? Well, the answer has to be this one, right? Because this one starts at pi. If you start at 0, there are no bound states. So it's the triplet. There is a bound state of a neutron and a proton, namely a deuteron, and it has spin 1. It has the neutron and the proton spinning in the same direction. So these are what this is what you measure, and you can extract this information for what the phase shift is as a function of energy. And I've mostly plotted this on the small scale because I did want to stress that this thing, that the phase shift for the singlet state, the anti-symmetric spins, does start at zero. There isn't a bound state of a neutron and proton that has spin zero, only spin one. And that's because this more professional looking plot starts out at really high energies, and it's hard to see that this singlet zero, it sure looks like that starts at 60 degrees, but that's because it zooms up in the first MeV of this 100 that are in this tick mark. It's zooming up from zero and then coming down, right? So here it's zooming up in a fraction of an MeV. And here's the triplet state, which starts at 180 degrees and basically just goes down. And here are all the other phase shifts for lots of these waves. Notice that, generally speaking, the other ones are small, right? Which is what I claimed. And so even at 100 MeV, the next wave, the L equals 1, is only at 10 degrees. And the sine of 10 degrees is pretty small, right? 0.2 or something like that. Okay, so I guess that clock's ahead, right? So I just finished on time.